Back in 1953, when Mount Everest was scaled for the first time by Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, they were hailed as heroes around the globe. But 55 years later, thousands of people have reached the summit of the tallest mountain in the world, and more are trying every year. In 2004, Michael Kodas attempted to climb Mount Everest and sent daily dispatches via satellite to the Hartford Courant newspaper in Connecticut. But instead of summiting, he came back with stories of sabotage, theft, prostitution, drug use, and death threats. And he wrote about it in a new book called High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in an Age of Greed. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've frequently done stories about what you call adventure journalism. You've trained to be a firefighter, and you've gone sea kayaking around Long Island Sound. What would you say was different about your two expeditions to Everest in 2004 and 2006 that made you want to write a book?
Well, I hadn't initially planned to write a book when I did the newspaper stories, although our expedition was fairly harrowing and I uncovered quite a bit of corruption and crime. However, on the day I turned back from the summit, largely due to the threats of one of my teammates, there was a doctor from Washington, D.C., who summited the mountain from the other side than I was climbing on and then vanished. And the circumstances were so suspicious that his daughter flew from Washington, D.C. to Kathmandu to investigate. And over a period of about a year and a half, she and then me following up on that investigation discovered enough fraud and theft and just a 10-year series of swindles that this man's guide had committed.
Now that's,
Made me think this is a trend.
Now, that's Dr. Niels Antezana. Is that how you say his last name?
That's correct.
And yep. I want you to tell his story a little bit later, but your story has enough crime and harrowing experiences to hold us for a few minutes. So let's start with, well, I think most people think of Everest as pristine wilderness, but not so much. Will you tell us what it's really like these days, what you saw?
Well, you know, you've got so many people going there and spending so much money that it's really become quite developed and drawn all kinds of activity. So, yeah, it doesn't seem anything like a pristine wilderness. If you climb from the Tibet side of the mountain, you'll actually arrive in base camp in a truck rather than hiking there. And the Chinese have built a small hotel near base camp and built a cell tower that provides cell service all the way to the summit now. And there's a small village of Tibetan and Chinese tents that sell wares and services to the climbers. So it actually looks a lot more like a mining town than a mountaineering camp.
And you even in your book, some people take helicopters to the base camp?
Yeah, choppering around the base camp in Nepal is pretty common. On the Chinese side, it's very rare because the Chinese government doesn't like helicopters that aren't their own traipsing around in Tibet. But in Nepal, there's a lot of helicopter traffic to and from base camp.
So let's start with your first attempt in 2004 with the Connecticut Everest expedition. Paint a picture for us. How did that expedition go for you?
Not very well. I got invited onto this expedition by a couple of my neighbors who between them have climbed Mount Everest 10 times. Actually, I think they've climbed it 15 times now, but at the time they'd climbed it 10 times. And they wanted to put together an expedition from Connecticut and wondered if I would come along to cover it. But by the time we got to base camp, they were hardly speaking to me. There were threats. 10 bottles of my oxygen and the team leader's oxygen vanished. All of our tents vanished. The ropes
I'm going to interrupt
vanished.
You, Michael. Will you explain to people why that's deathly that your oxygen tanks vanished?
Sure. Well, your life depends on it. When you get up high on the mountain, you buy a number of bottles of oxygen, usually about 5 per climber, that you'll use on the final days to the summit when the air is so thin that only the best mountaineers can survive without bottled oxygen. But the bottles themselves are quite expensive and are common targets for thieves. You're looking at about $450 for each bottle of oxygen. And the average income of a Nepali is less than half of that in a year. And a Tibetan probably makes, you know, a quarter of that in a year. So it's not surprising that the natives would target bottled oxygen for theft. What is surprising is how often the oxygen makes it onto into other Western climbers' camps and how often Western climbers will show up with no oxygen and then suddenly have some when they get up high on the mountain.
So let's go back to your attempt to summit. The team went ahead and promised they'd have a tent ready for you at a higher camp, but there was no tent?
Yeah, that happened a few times on my expedition where, you know, we had made arrangements and everything was set up for a tent to be in place, but the tent would vanish. When we actually got off the mountain of the, I believe, 15 tents that we took, all but two had gone missing. So, you know, obviously if you get up high on the mountain and you have no shelter, you're in dire straits. But that, you know, we weren't the only people that was happening to. You know, one story that was particularly striking to me was a climber named Marcin Miłka, a Polish climber who was one of the strongest climbers on the mountain in 2005. And he climbed the mountain without oxygen or Sherpa support and set up all three of his high camps, or two of his high camps initially. And, waited to acclimatize, and then when he returned to his camps one after the other, he went to his tents and opened the door to find all of his equipment missing, managed to borrow enough gear to set up a third camp at the highest camp on the mountain, and still summited the mountain. But when he returned to his highest camp after reaching the top of the world without bottled oxygen, he got back to his camp, opened his tent door, and all of his gear was gone again. And, you know, he nearly perished because of the theft of, you know, his colleagues on the mountain after achieving, you know, one of the great physical feats of, you know, of life.
We've got a few moments before the break. Michael, can you explain why you ended up turning back on your attempt to summit?
Well, I like to think that I would have made it to the summit. My teammate, Ann Parmenter, who was the leader of the expedition, and I got up to about 25,000 feet. But by that point, the man who had invited me on the team had started to threaten my life after I learned a number of things about my teammates and about him in particular, and things that had happened on the mountain. And I was reporting on the thefts and the gear that had vanished and some of the tensions on the on our team. Four of my teammates summited, but the expedition actually climaxed when, my teammate beat his wife and left her unconscious outside one of the tents on the mountain, and other women on the team were forced to go and rescue her.
Michael, we have to take a break, but in a minute I want to hear about how crime has infiltrated much more than just a couple of expeditions. Also, music from Canadian rapper Cadence Weapon. I'm Faith Saley, and this is Fair Game from PRI. I'm Faith Saley, and this is Fair Game from PRI. I'm speaking with Michael Kotis, author of the new book High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in an Age of Greed. Michael, before the break, we were talking about a lot of that greed is in the form of thieving, people stealing oxygen tanks and tents. Who's doing that? Is it other climbers, Sherpas, guides? Who's responsible?
A little bit of all of that. Among the native people that help climbers and are located around the mountain, it's not surprising. You're dealing with, at least in Nepal, the poorest country in South Asia. Tibet is the poorest region of China. And these people are desperate for income. So it's not surprising when you mingle the wealthiest adventurers in the world with the poorest people in the world, you're going to have a bit of a problem with theft. What is surprising is how often it's Western climbers who are showing up intentionally under-equipped, knowing that there are going to be better resourced people there that they're going to be able to take advantage of to get to the top of the mountain.
In reading your book, I was aghast at the stories of these nefarious activities that people are doing, but I was equally shocked by your descriptions about what it's just like to experience that physically. Can you talk about that? Just what that temperature feels like, what oxygen deprivation feels like? Can you share some of that with us?
Sure. You know, all of those things contribute to the problems. You know, when you are that high up on the mountain and your brain is deprived of oxygen, you know, you're not firing on all cylinders. And
you say that the body actually dies, right? You're dying.
Sure. Nobody's going to live up there forever or for any length of time. You know, you're in a place that no human being really belongs. So, you know, anybody that's up there is going to die in a fairly short period of time. People that are stronger or better acclimatized will last a little bit longer than others, but nobody can last for very long there. And your judgment really gets impaired by the lack of oxygen. You know, even a very acclimatized climber is going to not. You know, it's kind of like you're drunk. When you're in that situation, it's very, very cold. You're very debilitated. You're moving, you know, incredibly slowly. Everything takes forever. I mean, if you need to tie a shoe, it might take you 5 or 10 minutes. And time flies really quickly. And that puts you in a situation where you might be able to justify doing some things that you would never dream you would do if you were at sea level. You know, when you're not thinking that clearly and you're moving really slowly, you're very frightened. It's 20 or 30 degrees below zero and you see a tent or a sleeping bag or something that might help you get to the top or help you survive. It's a lot easier to justify it in that kind of a circumstance.
So you basically feared for your life, not from frostbite so much, but from your neighbor, your friendly neighbor, who went on the expedition with you in 2004. Your experience is not so unusual. Tell us about Niels Antezana, whose story is the other focus of your book.
Yeah, Niels Antezana was a very fascinating character to me. Niels was a doctor who, when he retired, kind of became an experience junkie. He got his pilot's license. He learned to scuba dive. And then he got very heavily into mountaineering. And while mountaineering in Bolivia, which is the country where he was born, although he was a U.S. citizen, he met a guide named Gustavo Lisi from Argentina. And Niels made plans to go and climb Mount Everest with Gustavo Lisi, primarily because he believed that Gustavo Lisi had climbed Everest before and that Gustavo Lisi had quite coveted international guiding certifications. After Niels vanished on the mountain, having paid quite a bit of money for the expedition with Gustavo, Niels' daughter learned that Niels' guide had actually not climbed Everest before. What he had done was abandon another climber on Everest and steal the man's photos from the summit and then publish those, claiming that it was him in the photos, not the gentleman he'd stolen the photos from. And he'd also forged his guiding certifications. So he didn't have at all the experience or the qualifications that Niels thought he had.
So Gustavo Lisi Niels actually summited with Gustavo Lisi. And they're walking.
That's correct.
They're walking down the mountain and apparently, there are different accounts, but Niels grabbed the legs of his Sherpa and said, "Don't leave me," and they kept going.
Yeah. They first, Gustavo Lisi abandoned Niels shortly after they summited. And then the Sherpas, who were struggling to get Niels down the mountain as he had more and more difficulty, eventually, probably fearing for their own lives, abandoned Niels as well as he grabbed at their legs and begged.
And then
that I learned in interviews both with the guide and with one of the Sherpas.
And then when Gustavo Lisi gets down the mountain, he tells his webmaster that he has summited and does not tell anyone that he's left Niels and Tanaza up there.
That's correct. Not only that, he actually broadcast that he had summited Everest and gotten a client to the top of Everest without mentioning that the client was probably at that point dead but had been abandoned below the summit.
Now, Dr. Antezana's daughter, as you say, sort of made it her life's mission to find out what happened to her father and to uncover the truth about Gustavo Lisi. Is he still being a guide on Everest?
He hasn't worked on Everest since that season, but he's still trying to work as a mountain guide in the Andes. And despite everything that he did and everything that's been uncovered about him, he really hasn't done anything that's actionable by the government in Nepal. They don't really keep much track of such things, and they don't impose much order on Mount Everest. So people can do these things there and basically walk away from it.
Well,
Michael, I think that's one of the big problems.
Yeah, I was going to say, who do you blame for this law?
Well, for the lawlessness, I think it's the climbers themselves to some degree. I mean, we all like to be in a place where, it's a wilderness, it's a wild place, and the rules are made by the people who go there. But as far as getting into a situation like that, it's a horrible series of swindles and frauds that Gustavo Lisi committed, but it's hard not to blame to some degree Niels Antezana himself, who should have been much more diligent in looking into his guide. And I can certainly be criticized for the same thing, as can a number of my teammates, that they talk about summit fever, wanting to get to the top of the mountain so bad that you make bad judgments on that final day that you're making it to the top of the mountain. But perhaps summit fever spreads a lot farther than that, even as far as the United States, when you're getting ready to go off on your adventure and you're unwilling to scrutinize the people you'll be going with too carefully for fear that you're going to lose this opportunity.
finally, Michael, you said it yourself. You're in a place when you go to Everest, you're in a place no human being ever belongs. Why do you do it?
Well, you know, when I grew up, we didn't have chicken bingo. So I was looking for something
to do. You need some thrills.
There's a guy named Luis Benitez who proved to be a valuable source to me. And he commented that, you know, he really loved working on Mount Everest despite the problems because he saw the absolute worst of humanity, but he also saw the absolute best of humanity. So, you know, there are some real heroics as well and some great behaviors, too. And I think that's one of the really appealing things about the book for me was that it was, it had both the good and the bad in it. And it was really a great detective story, you know, of somebody who really wasn't a climber finding out what had happened to her father, as well as the adventure in the mountains.
Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Michael Kodas is the author of High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in an Age of Greed. You can find out more about him on our website, morefairgame.org.